The network of
There is much gossip among the captains about
Persian by his rockets. I may specially mention his filling the great window at the east end of the south aisle of the church with figures admirably painted in glass, as his effigy and arms in the window attest. He also restored almost the whole of the abbot's lodging, and dug a well in the court of it, which he adorned with beautiful carvings in marble. He died rather suddenly in the 72nd year of his age, A.D. 1529. The object which the antiquary had before him at the moment was that of tracing the whereabouts of the painted windows of the Abbey Church at Stamford. Shortly after the Revolution, a very large quantity of painted glass made its way from the dissolved abbeys of Germany and Belgium to this country, and may now be seen adorning various of our parish churches, cathedrals, and private chapels. Steinfeld Abbey was among the most considerable of these involuntary contributors to our artistic possession. I'm taking the somewhat ponderous preamble of the book which the antiquary wrote, and the greater part of the glass from that institution can be identified without much difficulty by the help either of the numerous inscriptions in which the place is mentioned, or of the subjects of the windows, in which several well-defined cycles or narratives were represented. The passage with which I began my story had set the antiquary on the track of another identification. In a private chapel, no matter what, he had seen three large figures, each occupying a cold light in a window, and evidently the work of one artist. Their style made it plain that artist had been a German of the 16th century, but hitherto the more exact localizing of them had been a puzzle. They represented, will you be surprised to hear it, Job Patriarcha, Johannes Evangelista, Zacharias Professor, and each of them held a book or scroll inscribed with a sentence from his writings. These, as a matter of course, the antiquary had noted, and had been struck by the curious way in which they differed from any text of the Vulgate that he had been able to examine. Thus the scroll in Job's hand was inscribed, Auro est locus in quo absconditur, for conflictor. Footnote, translation. There is a place for gold where it is hidden. Return to text. On the book of John was habent investimentis suis scripturum quam nemo novit, for investimentis scriptum, the following words being taken from another verse. Footnote. Translation. They have on their raiment a writing which no man knoweth. Returned text. And Zacharias had super lapidem unum septum oculi sunt, which alone of all the clerestory windows of some precious church. But the passage on the Satan had altered the situation by showing that the names of the actual personages represented in the class now in Lord D's chapel had been constantly on the lips of Abbot Thomas von Eschenhausen of Steinfeld, and that this abbot had put up a painted window, probably about the year 1520, in the south aisle of his abbey church. It was no very wild conjecture that the three figures might have formed part of Abbot Thomas's offering. It was one which, moreover, could probably be confirmed or set aside by another careful examination of the glass. And, as Mr. Somerton was a man of leisure, he set out on pilgrimage to the private chapel with very little delay. His conjecture was confirmed to the full. Not only did the style and technique of the glass suit perfectly with the date place required, but in another window of the chapel he found some glass known to have been brought along with the figures, which contained the arms of Abbot Thomas von Eschenhausen. At intervals during his researches, Mr. Somerton had been haunted by the recollection of the gossip about the hidden treasure, and as he thought the matter over, it became more and more obvious to him that if the abbot meant anything by the enigmatic glance which he gave to his questioners, he must have meant that the secret was to be found somewhere in the window he had placed in the abbey church. It was undeniable, furthermore, that the first of the curiously selected texts on the scrolls in the window might be taken to have a reference to hidden treasure. Reader's note: the first text was, "There is a place for gold where it is hidden." Returned text: every feature, therefore, or mark which could possibly assist in elucidating the riddle which he felt sure the abbot had set to posterity, he noted with scrupulous care, and returning to his Berkshire manor house, consumed many a pint of the midnight oil over his tracings and sketches. After 2 or 3 weeks, a day came when Mr. Somerton announced to his man that he must pack his own and his master's things for a short journey abroad, whither, for the moment, he will not follow him. Chapter 2. Mr. Gregory, the rector of Parsbury, had strolled out before breakfast, director opened it and turned the signature, he realized that it came from a confidential valet of his friend at Square, Mr. Somerton. Thus it ran, "Honored sir, hence I am in a great anxiety about master. I write at his wish to beg you, sir, if you could be so good and step over. Master has had a nasty shock and keeps his bed. I never have known him like this, but no wonder, as nothing will serve but you, sir. Master says, would I mention the short way here is drive to Kipling's and take a trap, hoping I have made all plain, but am much confused in myself what with anxiety and weakness at night. If I might be so bold, sir, it would be a pleasure to see an honest British face amongst all these foreign ones. I am, sir, your obedient servant, William Brown. P.S. The thief, the term I will not term it, his name Steamfield. The reader must be left to picture to himself in detail the surprise, confusion, and hurried preparation into which the receipt of such a letter would be likely to plunge a quiet Berkshire parsonage in the year of grace 1859. It is enough for me to say that the train to town was caught in the course of the day, and that Mr. Gregory was able to secure travel on the Antwerp boat and a place in the Koblenz train. Nor was it difficult to manage the transit from that center to Steinfeld. I labor under a great disadvantage as the narrator of this story, in that I have never visited Steinfeld myself, and that neither of the principal actors in the episode, from whom I derived my information, was able to give me anything but a vague and rather dismal idea of its appearance. I gather that it is a small place with a large church despoiled of its ancient fittings, a number of rather ruinous great buildings, mostly of the 17th century, surround this church, for the abbey, in common with most those on the continent, was rebuilt in a luxurious fashion by its inhabitants at that period. It has not seemed to me worthwhile to lavish money on a visit to the place, although it is probably far more attractive than either Mr. Somerton or Mr. Gregory thought it. There is evidently little, if anything, of first-rate interest to be seen, except perhaps one thing, which I should not claim to see. The inn where the English gentleman and his servant were lodged is, or was, the only possible one in the village. Mr. Gregory was taken to it at once by his driver, and found Mr. Brown waiting at the door. Mr. Brown, a model wedding in his Berkshire home, of the impassive, whiskered race who are known as confidential valets, was now ingredient his relief at the sight of the honest British face of his rector was unmeasured, but words to describe it were denied him. He could only say, "Well, I am pleased, I'm sure so, to see you, and so I'm sure so, your master." "How is your master, then?" Mr. Gregory eagerly put in. "I think he's better, sir, thank you, but he's had a dreadful time of it. I hope he's getting some sleep now, but what has been the matter? I couldn't make it out from your letter. Was it an accident of any kind?" "Well, sir, I hardly know whether I'd better speak about it. Master was very particular. He should be the one to tell you. But there's no bones broke. That's one thing I'm sure you ought to be thankful." "What does the doctor say?" asked Mr. Gregory. They were by this time outside Mr. Somerton's bedroom door and speaking in low tones. Mr. Gregory, who happened to be in front, was feeling for the handle and chanced to run his fingers over the panels. Before Brown could answer, there was a terrible cry from within the room. "In God's name, who is that?" were the first words they heard. "Brown, is it?" "Yes, sir. Me, sir. And Mr. Gregory?" Brown hastened to answer, and there was an audible groan of relief in reply. They entered the room, which was darkened against the afternoon sun, and Mr. Gregory saw with a shock of pity how drawn, how damp with drops of feeling was the usually calm face of his friend, who, sitting up in the curtained bed, stretched out a shaking hand to welcome him. "Better for seeing you, my dear Gregory," was the reply to the rector's first question, and it was palpably true. After 5 minutes of conversation, Mr. Somerton was more his own man, Brown afterwards reported, than he had been for days. He was able to eat a more than respectable dinner, and talk confidently of being fit to start the journey to Koblenz within 24 hours. "But there's one thing," with the return of agitation which Mr. Gregory did not like to see, "which I must beg you to do for me, my dear Gregory. Don't," he went on, laying his hand on Gregory's before stool at the interruption, "don't ask me what it is or why I want it done. I'm not up to explaining it yet. It will throw me back. You needn't be in the least alarmed. It's perfectly safe in the daytime. You know what I mean. It lies on the step, you know, where we put it. Brown swallowed dryly by surprise, and failing to speak, bowed. And, yes, that's all. Only use one other word, my dear Gregory. If you can manage to keep the question brown about this matter, I shall be still more bound to you. Tomorrow evening, at the latest, if all goes well, I shall be able, I believe, to tell you the whole story from start to finish. And now, I wish you good night. Brown will be with me. He sleeps here. And if I knew you, I should lock my door. Yes, be particular to do that. They like it. People here. And it's better. Good night. Good night. They part at the darkness. And if Mr. Gregory woke once or twice in the small hours, fancied he heard a thumping about the apartment's locked door. It was perhaps no more than if a quiet man suddenly plunged into a strange bed, and the heart of a mystery might reasonably expect. Certainly, he thought, to the end of his days, that he had heard such a sound twice or three times between midnight and dawn. He was up with the sun, and out in company with Brown soon after. Perplexing as was the service he had been asked to perform for Mr. Somerton, it was not a difficult or an alarming one, and within half an hour from his leaving the inn, it was over. What it was, I shall not as yet divulge. Later in the morning, Mr. Somerton, now almost himself again, was able to make a start from Stanford, and that same evening, whether at Goblet's or at some intermediate stage of the journey, I'm not certain, he settled down to the promised explanation. Brown was present, but how much of the matter was ever really made plain to his comprehension, he would never say, and I am unable to conjecture. Chapter 3. This was Mr. Somerton's story. You know roughly, both of you, that this expedition of mine was undertaken with the object of placing something in connection with some old painted glass in Lord D's private chapel. Well, the starting point of the whole matter lies in this passage of an old printed book, to which I will ask your attention. And at this point, Mr. Somerton went carefully over some ground with which we are already familiar. On my second visit to the chapel, he went on, my purpose was to take every note I could of figures, lettering, diamond scratchings on the glass, and even apparently accidental markings. The first point which I tackled was that of the inscribed scrolls. I could not doubt that the first of these let it go. There is a place for the gold where it is hidden, with its intentional alteration, must refer to the treasure. So I applied myself with some confidence to the next, that of St. John. They have on their vestures a writing What's in the inscription on the robes of the figures? I could see none. Each of the three had a broad black border to his mantle, which made a conspicuous and rather ugly feature in the window. I was nonplussed, I allow, and, but for a curious bit of luck, I think I should have left the search where the Canon de Steinfeld had left it before me. But it so happened that there was a good deal of dust on the surface of the glass, and Lord D, happening to come in, noticed my blackened hands, kindly insisted on sending for a Turk's head broom to clean down the window. There must, I suppose, have been a rough piece in the broom, anyhow, as it passed over the border of one of the mantles. I noticed that it left a long scratch, and that some yellow stain instantly showed up. I asked the man to stop his work for a moment and ran up the ladder to examine the place. The yellow stain was there, sure enough, and what had come away was a thick black pigment, which had evidently been laid on with the brush after the glass had been burnt, and could therefore be easily scraped off without doing any harm. I scraped accordingly, and you'll hardly believe, now I do you an injustice, you will have guessed already, that I found under this black pigment two or three clearly formed capital letters in yellow stain on a clear ground. Of course I could hardly contain my delight. I told Lord D that I had detected an inscription which I thought might be very interesting, and begged to be allowed to uncover the whole of it. He made no difficulty about it whatever, told me to do exactly as I pleased, and then, having an engagement, was obliged, rather to my relief I must say, to leave me. I set to work at once, and found the task a fairly easy one. The pigment disintegrated, of course, by time, came off almost at a touch, and I don't think that it took me a couple of hours all told to clean the whole of the black borders in all three lights. Each of the figures had, as the inscription said, a writing on their vestures, which nobody knew. This discovery, of course, made it absolutely certain to my mind that I was on the right track. But now, what was the inscription? While I was cleaning the glass, I almost took pains not to read the lettering, saving up the truth until I had got the whole thing clear. And when that was done, my dear Gregory, I assure you, I could almost have cried from sheer disappointment. What I read was only the most hopeless bundle of letters that was ever shaken up in a hat. Here it is. Thank you.
Yeah.
Readers note, letters are underlined in the inscription as described above, and the resulting message is described in the following words from Sanuki. End of reader's note. Do you see it? Ekin, Midia, Auri, Requisita, Sunt Impiteo, In At. Footnote. Translation. 10,000 pieces of gold are laid up in a well in. Return to text. Followed by an incomplete word beginning AT. So far, so good. I tried the same plan with the remaining letters, but it didn't work, and I fancied that perhaps the placing of dots after the last three letters might indicate some different procedure. Then I thought to myself, wasn't there some allusion to a well in the account of Herbert Thomas in that book The Certain? Yes, there was. He built Epiteus in Atrio, a well in the court. There, of course, was my word Atrio. The next step was to copy out the remaining letters of the inscription, omitting those I had already used. That gave what you will see on the slip. The well in the court of the Abbot's House of Steinfeld. one hand the disappointment, on the other hand the danger. There is always a possibility that too much time or too dwell might have been wholly obliterated, or else that someone ignorant of cryptograms, and guided only by luck, might have stumbled on the treasure before me, and then criteria. I suppose the death of the god Sexitus had to be fate, but as to the other part, it really seemed as if the abbot had wished to lead searchers up to the very door of his treasure house, for as you can see for yourself, there were big blocks of stone bonded into the masonry, and leading down in a regular staircase, round and round to the inside of the well. It seemed almost too good to be true. I wondered if there was a trap, if the stones were so contrived as to tip over when a weight was placed on them. But I tried a good many with my own weight and with my stick, and all seemed that actually were perfectly firm. Of course, I resolved that Brown and I would make an experiment that very night. I was well prepared. Knowing the sort of place I should have to explore, I had brought a sufficiency of good rope and bands of weapons around my body, and crossbars to hold to, as well as lanterns and candles and crowbars, all of which could go into a single cartridge bag and excite no suspicion. I satisfied myself that my rope would be long enough, and that the wheel for the bucket was in good working order. And then we went home to dinner. I had a little cautious conversation with the landlord, and made out that he would not be overmuch surprised if I went out for a stroll with my man about 9 o'clock to make, heaven forgive me, a sketch of the abbey I moved. I asked no questions about the well, and am not likely to do so now. I fancy I know as much about it as anyone in Stamford, at least with a strong shudder. I don't want to know any more. Now we come to the crisis, and though I hate to think this, I feel sure, Gregory, that it will be better for me in all ways to recall it just as it happened. We started, Brown and I, at about 9 with our bag, and attracted no attention, for we managed to slip out at the hinder end of the inn yard, which brought us quite to the edge of the village. In 5 minutes we were at the well, and for some little time we sat on the edge of the well head to make sure that no one was stirring or spying on us. All we heard was some horses cropping grass out of sight further down the eastern slope. We were perfectly unobserved, and had plenty of light from the gorgeous full moon to allow us to get the rope properly fitted over the wheel. Then I secured the band round my body beneath the arms. We attached the end of the rope very securely to a ring in the stonework. Brown took the lighted lantern and followed me. I had a crowbar. And so we began to descend cautiously, feeling every step before we set foot on it, and scanning the walls in search of any marked stone. Half aloud, I counted the steps as we went down, and we got as far as the 38th before I noticed anything at all irregular in the surface of the masonry. Even there was more. A great flake of cement dropped off my feet, and I saw marks on the stone underneath. Armed tracks the object down my periphery. Even now I think it to a certain time. It took but a very few more cracks to clear the whole of the cement away, and I saw a slab of stone about 2 feet square, upon which was engraven a cross. Disappointment again, but only for a moment. It was you, Graham, who reassured me by a casual remark. You said fell on the rock. It's a funny cross, looks like a lot of arms. I snatched the lantern out of your hand and saw with inexpressible pleasure that the cross was composed of 7 eyes, 4 in a vertical line, 3 horizontal. The last of the scrolls in the window was explained in the way I had anticipated. Here was my stone with the 7 eyes. So far the other stone had been intact, and as I thought this, the anxiety about the guardian returned upon me with increased force. Still, I wasn't going to retreat now. Without giving myself time to think, I knocked away the cement all around the marked stone, and then buried the prize on the right side with my crowbar. It moved at once, and I saw that it was but a thin light slab, such as I could easily lift out myself, and that it stopped the entrance to a cavity. I did lift it out unbroken, and set it on the stack, for it might be very important to us to be able to replace it. Then I waited for several minutes on the steps above. I don't know why, but I think to see if any dreadful thing would rush out. Nothing happened. Next, I lit a candle, and very cautiously I placed it inside the cavity with some idea of seeing whether there were foul air and of getting a glimpse of what was inside. There was some flowers there which very nearly extinguished the flame, but in no long time it burned quite steadily. The hole went some little way back, and also on the right and left of the entrance, and I could see some round, as you might call it, objects within, which might be bags. There was no use in waiting. I faced the cavity and looked in. There was nothing immediately in the front of the hole. I put my arm and felt to the right very gently. Just give me a glass of coffee, Graham. I'll draw on in a moment, Gregory. Well, I felt to the right, and my fingers touched something curved that felt, yes, more or less like leather, dampish it was, and evidently part of a heavy, full thing. There was nothing, I must say, to alarm me. I grew bolder, and putting both hands in as well as I could, I pulled it to me, and it came. It was heavy, but moved more easily than I had expected. As I pulled it towards the entrance, my left elbow knocked over and extinguished the candle. I got the thing fairly in front of the mouth and began drawing it out. Just then, Graham gave a sharp ejaculation and ran quickly up the steps with the lantern. He'll tell you why in a moment. Startled as I was, I looked round after him and saw him stand for a minute then walked away a few yards. Then I heard him call softly, "All right." And went on through an upthrown bed in complete darkness. It hung for an instant on the edge of the hole, then slipped forward onto my chest and put its arms around my neck until it broke open, telling me the exact truth. I believe I am now acquainted with the extremity of terror and repulsion which a man can endure without losing his mind. I can only just manage to tell you now the bare outline of the experience. I was conscious of a most horrible smell of mold, and of a cold kind of face pressed against my own, and moving slowly over it, and of several, I don't know how many legs or arms or tentacles or something clinging to my body. I screamed out, Brown says, like a beast, and fell away backwards from the step on which I stood, and the creature slipped downwards, I suppose, off that same step. Providentially, the band round him held firm. Brown did not lose his head and was strong enough to pull me up to the top and get me over the edge quite promptly. How he managed it exactly, I don't know, but I think he would find it hard to tell you. I believe he contrived to hide our entrance in the deserted building nearby, and with very great difficulty he got me back to the inn. I was in no state to make explanations, and Brown knows no German. But next morning I told the people some tale of having had a bad fall in the Abbey ruins, which I suppose they believed. And now, before I go further, I should just like you to hear what Brown's experiences during those few minutes were. Tell the rector, Brown, what you told me. Walter, said Brown, speaking lower and nervously. It was just this way. Master was busy down in front of the owl, and I was over in the lantern, looking on, when I heard something drop in the water from the top, as I thought. So I looked up and I see someone's head looking over at us. I suppose I must have said something, and I held the light up and ran up the steps. And my light shone right on the face. That was a bad sort of ever I've seen one. A holdish man, and the face very much fell in and laughing, as I thought. And I got up the steps as quickly, you know, as I'm telling you. When I got out on the ground, there weren't a sign of any person. There hadn't been any time for anyone to get away, let alone that old chap. And I made sure we weren't crouching down by the well or nothing. Next thing, I hear Master cry out something horrible, and all I see is him hanging out by the rope. And as Master says, "Whatever I've got in my pocket, I'll tell you." "You hear that, Gregory?" said Mr. Sullivan. "Now, is there any explanation of that incident strike you?" "The whole thing is so ghastly and abnormal that I must own it puts me quite off my balance. But the thought did occur to me that possibly no better. I hurry for to get up. No dot to me. And this one had been terrible. I doubt it could have done much for me. I make Brown right off to you, and spend a second terrible night. And quickly, at least I'm sure my figure affected me more than the first shock, for it lasted longer. Those up on something on the watch outside my door the whole night. I almost felt a little too. It wasn't only the faint noises I heard from time to time all through the dark hours, but there was the smell, the hideous smell of mold. Every rag I had on me on that first evening, I had stripped off and made Brown take it away. I briefly stuffed the thing into the stove in his room, and yet the smell was there, as intense as it had been in the well, and what is more, it came from outside the door. But with the first glimmer of dawn it faded out, and the sounds ceased too, and that convinced me that the thing or things were creatures of darkness, and could not stand the day. And so I was sure that if anyone could put back the stone, it or they would be powerless until someone else took it away again. I had to wait until you came to get that done. Of course I couldn't send Brown to do it by himself, and still less could I tell anyone who belonged to the place. Well, there is my story. You don't believe it, I can't help it, but I think you do. Indeed, said Mr. Gregory, I can find no alternative. I must believe it. I saw the well and the stone myself, and had a glimpse, I thought, of the bags or something else in the hall. And to be plain with you, Hamilton, I believe my door was watched last night, too. I dare say it was, Gregory. But thank goodness it was over. Have you, by the way, anything to tell about your visit to that dreadful place? Very little, was the answer. Brown and I managed easily enough to get the stuff into its place. And he fixed it very firmly with the irons and the wedges he had desired him to get. And we contrived to smear the surface with mud, so it looked just like the rest of the wall. One thing I did notice in the carving on the wellhead, which I think must have escaped you, it was a horrid, grotesque shape. That's more like a toad than anything else. And there was a